Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Friday, and that means time for the Week in Review. And we'll start today with Boston police and body cams. This week, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh says police officers will have to wear body cams, whether they like it or not.
We told the people in Boston would have body camera program, and we're moving forward with a body camera program, and it's out in the street.
The police department decided to require 100 randomly selected officers to wear the cameras after no volunteers came forward for the city's pilot program. Here's reaction from NAACP Boston President Michael Curry.
If we can't anticipate that there'll be courage in law enforcement to get this done, and that there's some resistance in the unions, then we have to require them to do it.
Thus far, police unions have not commented. So we'll talk about the pilot program and other news of the week with today's Week in Review panel, which includes Charlie Chippio, senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and a research fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Charlie, great to see you.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Also with us is Tom Keene. He's a former Boston City Councilor and a regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinions page. Tom, great to have you.
Pleasure to be here.
Okay, so give both of you, give me your first line on this move that the Boston PD is going to require, require 100 randomly selected officers to wear body cams come September. Charlie, your take?
Well, my first take was just the fact that they didn't have a single volunteer, and that even offering a $500 stipend, they didn't have a single volunteer. I never imagined that this would be a popular thing, but the degree of the entrenched resistance to this, I have to say, really surprised me.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And it really does show this kind of schism between the viewpoint of the entire outside world, which is calling for at least a test of this, if probably not full implementation, and then the ranks within the BPD, which is resisting it. And I don't understand why, because I think ultimately body cams are really going to help the cops.
Okay, so maybe, I mean, that's one take on it from both of you. But another take comes from Boston Police Patrolmen's Association President Patrick Rose. I mean, he told the Boston Herald this. It's a quote. He said, "It may be that the problem with officers actually volunteering occurred because of the timing of the announcement of the pilot program. The city decided to agree to this program within a week of 8 police officers being murdered in 2 separate cities." Of course, he's referring to Dallas and Baton Rouge there. And meanwhile, our members, BPD members, were screaming for protection, which was falling on deaf ears. I mean, I think he has a point there, that they felt like they weren't being heard, and that virtually at the same time, within 8 days, they were told, you're going to have to wear body cams, Charlie?
Well, it just seems to me that might be apples and oranges, in the sense that, yes, we need to do more to protect police. There's no doubt about that. But I think that anybody who has seen, you know, the film of, for example, the guy in South Carolina who was shot in the back as he was walking away, you know, and those kind of things, know that we also have problems here. And I have to say, all the evidence suggests that things are better in Boston than they are in a lot of these cities where these problems have happened. But, you know, just because we need to have more accountability, and specifically when it comes to African-American males, we need to show that we have some concern for their lives, that doesn't mean that's not exclusive of trying to do more to help the cops and ensure their safety.
Well, Boston Police Commissioner Bill Evans told WGBH that he's expecting a challenge from the unions. Here's that.
Obviously, they'll probably challenge us that we're going to assign them, but that's what the union does. You know, they look out for their membership.
I mean, Tom, do you think that this decision could actually prolong the whole process?
Well, the fact that there's a challenge here suggests that the first excuse we heard from the BPD is not true, that it's not a timing issue, that in fact they're going to challenge it not because of timing, but because they don't want this to be done. I don't understand the rationale behind that, because I think in the long run, we'll find that body cams and other forms of scrutiny like this are going to encourage citizens to trust and work with the police more effectively.
Mm. We've got a little bit more tape here from Commissioner Evans, because he said some interesting things. And again, this is courtesy of WGBH. He said that he actually spoke to all the officers at roll call to announce the decision. And then he said this.
You know, we have nothing to hide. This is a good program. And I think the younger officers get it. They're in on the technology. But the older officers who, it's a big change in the way they did policing.
Any credence to that, Charlie?
I think that there may be some truth to the fact that there's more resistance among the older officers. But it strikes me that not a single person volunteering also includes the younger officers.
True. So, the entire police force.
Right. Yeah, so, I mean, I can't imagine that they're completely bought into it.
Okay. So here's what I'm wondering. You know, beforehand, they were seeking volunteers. And a lot of people were wondering, okay, if volunteers had come forward, would these be the officers who would be least likely to...
they would be the good guys.
The good guys.
Right.
Tom's words. I mean, if by September we do have 100 randomly selected officers, I asked a guest on our show this earlier in the week, and I'm just wondering what the two of you think about it. You know, it seems as if we may actually have a greater sense of reality in terms of the experience of police officers and the citizens that they encounter every day because of the random selection here.
That was exactly my reaction, yes.
I think that's completely true. And a lot of people from the outside looking in at this were really wondering about the volunteer program. That, in fact, if you want to see whether this is effective, do it somewhat randomly, see what you're picking up, and see whether that then allows the pilot to go to a full-blown implementation.
Mm. Yeah. No, I think that's right.
Well, a lot of agreement at this table today.
Sorry about that.
But by the way, if anybody wants to pay me $500 to wear a body cam while I'm writing a column or something, I'm up for it. There'd be no problem.
I do want to reiterate that we have repeatedly reached out to the Boston Police Unions for comment, and they have not gotten back to us, and we'll keep doing so, and hopefully we'll hear from them. All right, well, let's move on to another story that really disturbed and captivated us this week that has to do with a report by the Disability Law Center that alleges a private special education school in Middleborough with abuse and neglect.
This school holds itself out as a therapeutic school. It is saying to families, we are specially set up to treat, to watch out, to take appropriate care. These youngsters come there with challenging behaviors, but they have to take adequate steps.
Well, that's Stan Eichner. He's director of litigation at the Disability Law Center. And some background here. The report that they put out alleges that staff at the Chamberlain International School did not do enough to prevent suicide attempts or prevent students from harming themselves. Some staff allegedly were verbally and emotionally abusive towards students. And allegedly, they did not supervise students well enough or have, again, allegedly proper safety procedures in place. We spoke to one parent, Jacqueline Dynan from Pembroke, New Hampshire, who sent her 13-year-old son to Chamberlain in 2014. She said he was verbally abused by staff and ended up running away, and that police were not notified by the school, but a civilian found Dynan's son.
My son just left the grounds and started running through people's yards, he told me, and I didn't know he was gone.
Now, of course, the Chamberlain International School denies the allegations. But Tom, let me just start with you. Your thoughts on this story?
So I've read the DLC's report. I've read the response from the school, and it's obviously hard to sort out fact from fiction. There's clearly enough here to suggest that it should go to the state regulatory agencies for investigation. But here's one thing that seems pretty clear to me: that the origin of this report was basically grounded in a custody battle between a non-custodial parent who made the allegations and the custodial parent who actually very much was supportive of the school. So it sounds like a little bit like it's a custody battle and divorce proceeding. Most of the allegations that initiated this particular investigation were in fact found not to be true. What happened is that in the course of the investigation, a number of other items, many of them already reported by the school, were brought to light, such as the fact that you had kids running away, such as the fact that the school actually had a standard for bullying that's an outmoded standard, mm-hmm. and one that clearly is not in keeping with where the state where state law is today. But I'm a little bit wary about a lot of the smoke from here and not sure that there's much fire there as we think.
Charlie?
Well, I got to tell you, I have a very personal take on this because I have two kids that are in therapeutic schools. And, you know, this reading about this, it all rang true. I mean, it's exactly what I experienced, which is that you have the same school and you have kids who are well suited for that school and who are a good fit for that school. And the parents will tell you this is the greatest place in the world. You have the exact same school and you have kids who are not a good fit for that school. And it will sound like a torture chamber. And you know, I think that every SPED parent who has kids in these therapeutic schools, you know, has been through this. And I think that my take from this is that the real issue here is that you have a process in which you are having to fight school districts tooth and nail to get them to agree to this, no matter what your kids have been through.
Because the district funds
the district doesn't
the
want to do it. The yeah. district will tell you, oh, we can handle this no matter what.
Yeah, they don't want to pay for it.
Right, because they have to pay for
yeah.
it.
Yeah, and no matter, I mean, you know, I have my own experiences with this. And yet, so, you know, and then finally, you know, after you've gotten paid for the lawyer and the advocate and all this stuff, and you finally sort of get them to agree to do this, you're faced with a situation of, that you are totally unprepared for, which is trying to pick which school is correct for your kid, which is, I mean, it's just, it's overwhelming. And so that's why I think you very often get these situations where you have a mix of kids who are well-suited and doing well and other kids who are really a poor fit.
So Charlie, help us get some insight here then, because you do have experience in this. Because one of the things that I wondered, which was, it was a question that was raised by Shannon Dooling, WBR's reporter, who's been doing extensive yeah. reporting on this. I mean, she talked to 24 families, or parents and families. And she pointed out that these schools they seek to support, you know, kids with a wide variety of challenges, but they are mandated to do so in the least restrictive environment possible.
That's
and
right.
So oftentimes that's a very hard balance to strike, especially when the challenges that the kids are facing are so varied.
It's a very hard balance, and that's why in this case you have kids who, you know, who part of the problem is apparently that they're leaving the campus. Well, you, of course, you know, they're trying to make it as unrestrictive as possible.
It's not a jail.
It's right.
Right.
You know, it's
not a locked facility.
You know, it's very difficult. And you get some of these facilities, some of these schools, for example, who really focus on, you know, saying we're not for kids who have behavioral problems, for example. Yet no matter how much you try, the screening process fails sometimes and you end up with kids that have behavioral problems and they're not really equipped to handle them and causes all kinds of problems both for the kid and for the rest of the class.
But as Tom pointed out, having outmoded standards for bullying, certainly, I mean, that can't be acceptable.
Oh, yeah. Right? No, believe me, I'm certainly not trying to say that they are blameless and all this kind of stuff. I'm just saying that this whole what's happened here is part of a much bigger and more complex problem.
Well, Tom and Charlie, I'll turn back to you on this, but do you have any thoughts on then how state oversight could improve or maybe regulatory changes that might actually help in this situation?
Well, it does raise the question. I mean, first of all, the DLC actually is federally authorized and it is part of kind of the regulatory structure, albeit at a federal level.
Right.
But it is state authorities that do it. The school has actually pointed out on a number of occasions that as far as the state regulators are concerned, it's okay. Now, if that's really the case in terms of the bullying standard, and that was the most disturbing thing, I think, to me that actually came out of here because it was so current and seemed so prevalent, and the school was actually defending it, saying that this isn't bullying, when I think to an outside person it looks like bullying, that starts to suggest that maybe we need to have some stepped-up state regulation or oversight. And, you know, again, I haven't looked at the budget on it, but my guess is you're going to find that you have a regulatory agency that is somewhat strapped for funds, as we've seen yeah. across the board on a whole variety of issues. And, you know, you need to have the money come from somewhere. We don't have a state budget right now that's really dramatically expanding.
Yeah. And I would say that, you know, anybody who thinks that, you know, the whole thing with the Department of Children and Families, mm-hmm. you know, that's a horrible thing. And we're working to fix it. You know, I think anybody who thinks that if we didn't dig into a whole variety of other human service agencies, we wouldn't find similar things, unfortunately, right. is naive.
Mm. Well, we'll keep taking a look at this issue because I feel like there's a lot more to discuss, and we'll definitely do that in the days and weeks ahead. But before we run out of too much time, I actually just wanted to talk about the weather a little bit. Because
sunny and dry.
Sunny and dry. We'd need some major rainfall, so here's some tape.
Dairy farmers do not have hay or pasture to graze because it's all burnt up, so they don't have food. Cranberry growers don't have water to do harvest in the fall. Vegetable crops growers don't have enough water to water their vegetables. They take a lot of water, and so a lot of them have to make the hard decision of which fields do we abandon and which do we water.
Well, that's Michael Smolak, a third-generation farmer in North Andover. On Thursday, the U.S. Drought Monitor more than quadrupled the area of the state of Massachusetts considered to be under extreme drought. That now includes nearly 17% of the state's landmass. And so Governor Baker urged residents to conserve water.
We had a pretty light winter, and we found an incredibly dry summer. And those things by themselves have consequences for farming and consequences for agriculture generally, but they also have public safety issues, which we think are important for people to keep in mind as well.
160 communities, 160, I should say, have instituted some kind of restriction on water use. Tom, I mean, do you think that the Baker administration may consider even statewide water restrictions?
It may. I mean, I think a couple of things. First of all, we're now learning to regret the mild winter we had.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. Because if we had a lot of snowfall, we wouldn't have had this. Yeah. We wouldn't have this issue right now. The second is, as bad as it is here, it's a lot worse, say, in places like California, and we should really kind
of keep
that.
And it's constant there.
And it's constant there, and we really should keep that in mind. We may very well need to start going over to more restrictive types of controls. Let's see what the next few weeks bring in terms of weather. I know we're in a drought situation right now. This is not a crisis situation for most of the state.
Yeah, it seems like things are not as bad once you get outside 495 and move west. Not to say things
knock
are
on
wonderful.
Wood, right? Yeah, right.
No,
you know,
right.
The thing though is we also this week had that news that July was the hottest July since this is an exaggeration, but since records basically were
that's no exaggeration.
That's, yeah,
that is exactly
that's,
right.
Yeah, that's right.
So that makes me wonder. I mean, okay, so we may not be in sort of a California type crisis here in Massachusetts yet, but it seems like we ought to be thinking, and maybe some at the state and local level about how to deal with, you know, year after year of this kind of weather.
No, I mean, look, I agree with that. I am not – look, the last time I took one science class in college, which was an astronomy class called Great Moments in Astronomy, which was designed for, you know, a sort of science for writers like me. But look, it just certainly appears to me that it's a stretch to try to claim that something is not going on with the climate and that we certainly need to move sooner rather than later and very aggressively to start addressing these issues, or our kids, certainly I think it could be that soon, are going to have to face some issues that we shouldn't force them to face.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right. This is becomes increasingly hard for anyone who's rational to dispute the notion that there really is human-induced climate change, and that's what we're seeing here.
Well, let's have a little bit of happy news to wrap up this week's Week in Review. It's time for our hubbubs, and those are the stories that maybe didn't get the attention we think they deserved this week. And Charlie, let's start with your hubbub.
Well, I do. Mine is a happy one. I want to just talk a little bit about Topsfield's own Abby D'Agostino, this woman who was running in the 5,000-meter race in the Olympics, and she, by mistake, tripped up another woman. They both fell, and instead of just moving on, she stopped and urged the other woman. Her name was Nikki Hamblin from New Zealand. Said, "It's the Olympics. You got to finish." And she got up and she did do that. And Abby, the woman from Topsfield, did the same thing, meaning that she ran the last 2,000 meters of the race with a torn anterior cruciate ligament.
Ow!
Which is unheard of, I think. And you know, the two of them have been great in terms of how much they sort of appreciated each other, and it's just been a really nice kind of a nice moment in the whole sort of Olympics, which has had a little bit of a checkered history and some of the some other issues right now in these current Olympics as well. So I think it's been sort of a moment for us to all focus on what's good about the Olympics.
Olympic, the height of a true Olympic spirit.
The Olympic spirit, exactly.
Tom, you're going to bring us the
now,
depths.
I'm going to bring us to the depths of the Olympic experience. And those depths happen to be American swimmer Ryan Lochte, who likes to present himself as a goofball and an oddball. But his antics in Brazil, where, if you remember, he falsely claimed he was robbed at gunpoint, when in fact it was he and some teammates who drunkenly busted up a gas station restroom, those were none of those things. They were vicious, wrong, and played into people's bigotry and prejudices. And they were also reminiscent to me of Boston's 1989 Charles Stewart incident. In that notorious case, Stewart murdered his pregnant wife for insurance money, but he pinned the blame on an anonymous black attacker. Back then, the media swallowed whole Stewart's lies, eager to believe the narrative of an African-American inner-city urban crime. So, too, American media this time around eagerly believed Lochte, as his story fed into this widespread narrative of Brazil as an out-of-control country near collapse. Lochte has now apologized, but frankly, I think that's not enough. He's a national embarrassment. He's a man who, trying to cover up his own crime, smeared a people and a nation. He's no longer fit to represent the U.S. in any future Olympics, or for that matter, in any future contest whatsoever.
I think you make an excellent point that, I mean, there's so much going on in this story, and the comparisons are really interesting. But really, I feel like all of us, when Lochte first said, claimed, like, we were held, everybody believed him.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah. And that, and, you know, shame on all
and
of
he
us.
Got out of town in time, whereas these other two guys, they went, got on the plane and
they were
dragged
off.
Off the plane.
So. Yeah. And, I mean, his apology, in quotes, I'm going to put that in quotes, was not really
sort
that
like
much.
Sort of like a Donald Trump apology.
Right.
It was,
yeah.
not an, it was a non-apology apology, I read. It really was very weak.
And it's really too bad because the Brazilians didn't deserve that treatment. And it also really overshadowed for a while all the great stuff that's been happening at this Games, especially from Team USA. All right, so I am going to wrap up with a totally different kind of sport. It's a little preview. My hubbub's a preview of tomorrow on the Charles River. The Red Bull Flugtag is coming to Boston. And that's where teams get together and they build flying machines and they hurdle these flying machines off a 28-foot platform and they plunge into the Charles River. It's really quite a sight to see. And we've got teams from all over Massachusetts. We've got Northeastern University teams. We've got MIT teams from the Draper Lab. There's a bunch of them from the Draper Lab. There's one representing Boston schools here, the Boston School District. I want to see if I can find their entry information. I'm looking for it right now, and now I can't find it. But it's pretty funny because they all try to trash talk each other. Here it is. The name of the team is Mass Instruction. What they're building a pencil with lined paper for wings. And they have and teams get to trash talk each other. And the BPS teacher's trash talk is, "We may not be experts, but those who underestimate our ability will be inside for recess." So the Flugtag coming to the Charles River tomorrow. I'm going to do my best to be there. It'll be fun to watch. That is the end of this week's Week in Review. Charlie Chipio, senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute. Always great to have you, Charlie. Thank you so much.
Good to be here.
And Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinion page. Thanks, Sean.
My pleasure.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.